The number of recent Christian martyrs is staggering. 90,000 Christians are estimated to have died for the faith in the past year alone. Wondering what to think and how to prepare to endure persecution yourself? Check out Maze, the Lutheran Witness, for insight on memorizing the scriptures, learning from the early church martyrs, and looking to Christ on the cross for comfort. Not a subscriber? Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness for a special offer. $6.99 for 6 digital or print issues. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
If you want a perfect picture of masculinity, get yourself a crucifix and put it on your wall or hang it around your neck, because the cross is the most masculine thing that has ever happened.
I think to the extent secular progressivism seeks to answer these ultimate questions, it is a religion just as much as Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are religions.
Then he points us back to Genesis chapters 1 and 2. The fact that Adam is given one wife. So the Lord says, in the beginning it is not so.
The problem that apparently the women faced was the stone, which is not the problem. The problem that they faced was a dead Savior, a dead Jesus.
Just a taste of the soundbites we're going to be playing for you 1 hour from now when we play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We'll play them in their entirety, and then after you've listened to the 4 soundbites, it'll be your opportunity to win the LPR bundle package, an I Have Issues t-shirt, travel mug, pen, bumper sticker, and notepad that goes to the listener with the best vote for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. When you vote, make sure you tell us who you are, where you are, and why you're voting for the soundbite you're voting for. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway joins us. She's a Fox News contributor. I'd like to get her thoughts on the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency. Yesterday, we talked with her husband, Mark Hemingway, and got his thoughts. Also, there has been some opposition from trans activists to a presidential appointment to the Office of Civil Rights, who happens to be a regular guest here on Issues Etc., Roger Severino. Find out what she thinks about that as well. She's written about it recently in The Federalist, and it's titled Trans Activists Want to Destroy This Trump Appointee for Not Being a Radical, in addition to her new book, Trump Versus the Media. Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's great to be here with you.
Yesterday, we had your husband on to kind of give his assessment of President Trump's first 100 days in office. What's yours?
Well, I'm not a huge fan of the 100 days construct, in that I don't think people really judge presidencies by how much they do in the first 100 days. And even if they do typically judge presidencies by the first 100 days, this is the presidency not to do that with, because Trump is such a political neophyte. He has upended all sorts of conventions here in D.C., about how to do things. And so it's, you know, if you have to talk about it, it's kind of a mixed bag. He's had some really good work done through executive order or through rescinding executive orders that were deeply problematic from the Obama administration. He did the single most important thing he had to do for his entire presidency, which is nominate Neil Gorsuch and get him confirmed to the Supreme Court. Legislatively speaking, it's not a lot of accomplishment yet, and the president does have a responsibility there to work with Congress to accomplish his vision. But that is something where it's not just a president who's unaccustomed to this type of work. It's a Congress that has not known what it is like to be in the party of power. So I'm more interested in what happens maybe in the next few months to come, both in terms of health care reform and this tax package that we will likely learn a lot more about.
Well, one more question on that, Molly. I don't want to trigger strife in the Hemingway household, but yesterday your husband spoke rather glowingly of the airstrike on Syria. He said it was a total reset of foreign policy in the Middle East. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that would be a difference of agreement that we have. I do think there's a very good position to be had, which is that you enforce the norm against chemical weapons use. That is a norm that we have held in the civilized world for 100 years, and it's very important that we keep that norm. Having said that, I do believe that a big draw for Donald Trump's voters was that he was willing to upend the way we do foreign policy in this town, which has very little difference from left to right in terms of interventionism, trying to force our way of governing on other countries, irrespective of their values. And Donald Trump said these things that were very different from that. And he has seemed to back away from a lot of that, not just with the Syrian airstrikes, his posture toward Russia, he seems to be encouraging his military generals to think about re-upping the conflict in Afghanistan since Russia is involved there, as if, you know, the last 15, 16 years have not taught us anything about the ability to win the war there or what that would even look like. And then the growing conflict with North Korea, which is a very legitimate threat that had been ignored by the previous administration, unfortunately. But we want to make sure we don't escalate it ourselves. So I think we don't know a lot about what his foreign policy will look like, but there's reason for everybody to kind of be on guard and monitoring it, particularly if they were hopeful that he would do military action that was in the nation's interest as opposed to nation building or some of the other flawed strategies we've had in the past.
Turning to our subject, a regular guest here on the program, Roger Severino, has been tapped by President Trump for a position, and he's meeting quite a bit of opposition given his track record. What is the new standard of bigotry being applied to Roger Severino?
Right, Roger Severino is a man with a tremendous background in litigation involving civil rights. He worked under the Obama in the Obama administration as a non-political appointee in the Office of Civil Rights in HUD, and he has done great work as an attorney. Prior to his time in the executive branch, and then for a couple years after in the last year when he left, he worked at the Heritage Foundation working on religious liberty issues, which is the most important civil rights or, you know, civil liberties issue that we're dealing with right now. And because a lot of the trans ideology, which is still developing, so it's kind of hard to know even what that means, but because it's still developing, it's routinely running into conflict with religious liberty, trans activists are upset with him because he has been a strong advocate for making sure that the law upholds the First Amendment rights that Americans have, and also the rights of privacy and security that sometimes come in conflict with the trans agenda. And so you have lobbying groups, which stood to benefit quite a bit under the Obama administration's rewriting of trans policy, sometimes reinterpreting laws that were meant to protect women as laws that protect gender identity issues. And they are concerned because he is aware of how those things can conflict with religious liberty or otherwise. So they got 12 senators to write a letter kind of threatening Tom Price, who is the Health and Human Services Secretary, to make sure that Severino, you know, wouldn't be involved in any issues dealing with trans issues. I actually don't think it's going to have much of an effect because Severino is so well regarded.
So it seems as though the problem of these activists is not so much with Severino in particular, because they didn't raise any objections during his time more pivotally connected to human rights and civil rights in the Obama administration. The problem seems to be with the First Amendment and other parts of the Constitution.
Not just that, but in their letter that they wrote to Tom Price, they said, his entire career has been nothing but bigotry. And they didn't substantiate that at all in two different ways. One, the only thing they're trying to focus on is his last year at the Heritage Foundation, as opposed to his lengthy career litigating these issues. And two, what he's actually said is not bigoted in any way, unless you believe that someone being pro-life makes you a bigot, or someone believing that humans are made male and female, you know, basic science. Unless that makes you a bigot, this definition of bigotry is insane. And furthermore, conflating these two things of, you know, traditional conservative or religious beliefs with bigotry is actually very dangerous rhetoric. And you saw it in how this SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, sometimes it tries to say that if you have traditional religious values that you are a threat to America. And some people have taken those things so seriously that they've even, you know, gone into violent work. Like there was a man who used the Southern Poverty Law Center's map of hate groups, and it was really just like Christian groups, and used it and went into an office and tried to commit mass murder. And thankfully, he was stopped by a guard who was shot and survived. But he was hoping to kill everybody in the office. I mean, you have to be careful about your rhetoric. And so it's very disappointing to see 12 senators, 12 Democratic senators, glom onto this type of thinking.
What does that tell you, that the ease with which trans activists can garner Senate signatures. That's not an easy thing to get.
Well, you know, it is interesting, and it speaks to sort of what's happening in the Democratic Party, and I think a lot of people focus on conflict or craziness that's happening in the Republican Party, but there is a push on the left for the latest sort of progressive craze, and that's definitely the trans movement. I don't think people have really thought it through again. I mean, legally, it's very difficult to rewrite the laws that govern protection for the sexes or privacy for the sexes into something based on, you know, which is an objective reality, into something that's based on feelings. And if we do redefine the law that way, it causes all sorts of problems. And it really rolls back the protections that women have fought so hard to get in this country and elsewhere to make sure that because we are, you know, weaker sex, more vulnerable sex, we do fight for these protections. And if all of a sudden being a woman is nothing more than the product of your feelings that you have and not the objective reality that exists in the difference between the sexes, that is, you know, it's a threat to women, basically.
The term comes to mind, social experiment, when the trans agenda starts to impinge as it has so quickly on our legal system, and not to even mention, you know, our social system. But this goes beyond a social experiment. This seems like just kind of recklessly mixing chemicals in a lab, just wondering what might happen.
You know, there are multiple issues here, though. There's the very real issue of confusion or disorientation about one's sex or a focus on their gender identity, which is a very real problem that people should deal with lovingly and whatnot. There's the much larger issue of how, because there is this like sort of tiny prevalence of this thing, that everybody needs to rewrite their brain and they need to say things that aren't true. They need to adopt pronouns that are inaccurate or deny scientific reality. That's a very threatening thing, you know, when they're kind of trying to make, when the society and its forces, cultural forces, are trying to make you say things that aren't true, that is a very good groundwork for a type of totalitarianism that we should all fight against. And so it works because people want to be compassionate to people who are going through this problem, and that's how that people are sort of able to accomplish so much. But people really need to guard their brains and make sure that you don't let people force you to say things that aren't true. I mean, that's what dystopic novels are built around, this idea of a powerful force getting you to agree to an alternate reality that doesn't actually exist.
Should we see this, in a sense, the attempt to thwart Severino, as a trial balloon for a lot of other unfilled seats in the Trump administration that he still needs?
Absolutely. And, you know, on this note, it's really interesting because many conservatives made common cause with Donald Trump, which confused a lot of people, given that Donald Trump himself is not, you know, what you call a traditional social conservative. If he has social conservative positions, he kind of adopted them late. His rhetoric on various issues is mixed. And all these people decided that this was their best course of action for the way going forward. And it's worked out really well, actually. There are many conservatives working all across the executive branch, not as many as are needed for advancing their goals, but it's working out really well. At the same time, there has been a large-scale AstroTurf and highly funded political campaign to pick people off and to really destroy them. And so if people fall or if people are able to be picked off, it just emboldens the political opponents who are doing this and gives them much more momentum to go after the next person. And so people need to not back down. I mean, if a bully comes after you and you cower in response, it just emboldens the bully.
Do you agree with your husband, who observed yesterday, all said with regard to assembling an administration, Trump, maybe even in spite of himself, is putting together a fairly solid conservative group of administrators?
Well, I'm so happy to hear that my husband said that. That's great. I totally agree. And in fact, I think it's funny, we talk about, here in this town, there's so much anti-Trump sentiment on both left and right. You have a lot of people on the right who are just mortified by his presidency. And the thing I think is interesting is you had, you know, in previous years, men like George W. Bush, or people running for office like Mitt Romney or John McCain. And, Each of these three men had conservative aspects to them and certainly identified as conservatives. But when it came to their actual policy or even their actual governance, there wasn't necessarily a lot to show for it, or it was a very mixed record. I'm not denying that with Donald Trump, you're going to get that same mixed record, or that he's even, I'm not going to deny he's sort of rewriting what it means to be a conservative, or that there are all these kind of realignments on issues, you know, whether it's immigration or trade or whatnot. But if you just look at the actual output, Donald Trump, and I don't know if it's just because he outsources it to Mike Pence or what the deal is, but you have some real conservative accomplishments. You have really good conservative appointees. I mean, it was just announced that Charmaine Yost is the assistant secretary at HHS, a real, not just a pro-life person, but the former president of Americans United for Life. The person who held her position just left to go to Planned Parenthood. So, you know, that was the equivalent of what was happening under the Obama administration. These are aggressive moves. If you look at who was appointed to the EPA, someone who really understands environmental protection and is anti-regulation, I don't think that, you know, Romney or McCain would have had the courage to make that type of bold appointment and stick with it. So, again, mixed bag, but there's a lot for conservatives to be happy about right now.
Before we let you go, tell us about your new book, Trump versus the Media.
Yes, it's an encounter broadside, which means it's more like a long magazine article length, and it's available on Amazon, and it's a very reasonable price, I will mention. And it looks at how a lot of privilege has been accorded the media on the idea that they will try to do their jobs well with some sort of semblance of objectivity, and that they will do their work in the public interest. And as in the last year, the media kind of gave up the ghost of trying to even pretend that they were objective, where they were openly advocating against Donald Trump, or, you know, where you could see the disparity in the coverage so much that it was almost laughable. What happens to the credibility of the media, and then what happens to civil discourse when people have lost trust in the media? And so I kind of look through not just the last year, but even going back into what brought us to last year in terms of a declining trust in the media, and then pose some questions about what that means going forward.
You can purchase Trump versus the Media by Molly Hemingway and read her latest column at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Molly Hemingway is senior editor of The Federalist, author of the new book, Trump versus the Media, and that recent column, Trans Activists Want to Destroy This Trump Appointee for Not Being a Radical. Molly, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
Wesley Smith will be with us on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about conflating science with politics and the March for Science. What were they protesting exactly? We'll find out after this.
The fake news wars that we're experiencing right now are not going to end soon.
Terry Mattingly, on his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, making the case for news discernment.
We're actually seeing a war to define what is and what isn't news. This whole thing is about the purpose of journalism and whether the classic American model of the press, with its whole emphasis on balance and fairness, is going to survive the internet age. What we'll be talking about is where savvy readers can go to get their news. We're also going to ask, what happens to American public discourse if we all keep on clicking on news sources that only tell us what we want to hear?
You can meet and hear Terry Mattingly June 9th and 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to Sacred Music for the Easter Season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.